I can power up and level up at any moment. Spin like a semi, only get me semicolon. That's Denzel Curry. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Toronto Blue Jays powered up last night. Five homers for the first time in exactly one calendar year since August 20th, 2023 against the Cincinnati Reds. They hit five home runs then. They did not do it again until yesterday, August 20th, 2024, against the Cincinnati Reds. Five homers in a 10-3 victory. You got one from Leo Jimenez, one from Alejandro Kirk, one from Spencer Horwitz, and a pair from George Springer who needed it. I mean, they all needed it lately. The Jays have been playing some more fun baseball, winning, you know, about half their games against lesser competition here in the weaker part of the schedule. But the home runs still haven't been coming. Nice to see them get five. Nice to see them, you know, they're up to about league average since the trade deadline now when it comes to home run and overall offense. So that's encouraging to see as we see guys play out the string here and guys early audition for 2025 roles. Of course, George Springer and Alejandro Kirk pretty locked into those roles, but still nice to see them go yard several times. Again, five home runs combined. Jose Berríos did not allow one, so Cutter Crawford will get to add to his major league lead here next time out. Berríos gave him seven innings, a two-run ball. Was back to a little bit more swing and miss stuff than we've seen lately. Stole a couple called strikes here and there as well. Kind of went away from the slurve because the sinker-changeup combination was working a little better. It was nice. Jose Berríos gets the W in that one. On the red side, we got to see old friend Luke Maley on the mound for the second time this year. He pitched. He's pitched a bunch for the Cincinnati Reds over the years. He's pitched for the Blue Jays back when he was the team's backup and third catcher. He threw two perfect innings last night with the Reds down eight. So that was a fun cap on this one as well. We got a loaded show today. We're going to talk to Darren Van Riper of The Athletic of Rates and Barrels, talk some, you know, stretch run fantasy baseball, take a look at the Milwaukee Brewers who lead the NL Central, but the models don't really love them as World Series, as a World Series option just yet. We'll talk to our pal Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, kind of go around baseball as we always do. Madison Shipman will join us a little later to break down some of what she's seeing at the plate with some of these young Blue Jays. Right now, we're joined by Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Caitlin, good morning. How are we doing?
Good. How are you?
I am good. Were you as psyched as I was that we got to see Luke Maley pitch yesterday?
Of course. Of course. It's always a good day when you get to see a position player pitching, obviously when it's for the other team. When we see that for the Blue Jays, it means it's not gone well. But yes, obviously, like when Luke Maley's in town, he was always a nice guy to talk to, a nice guy to always very insightful, I found, with Luke Maley. So nice to see him get up on the mound.
Well, you know my my thing for backup and third string catchers, so obviously I'm a big Luke Maley fan. Caitlin, this is the second time he'd pitched this year, the ninth time he's pitched in his career. The ERA is not that good. He has like a 7.84, but he unleashed some knuckleballs yesterday. I think one was like 41 miles an hour. The Jays have a hole at backup catcher and the bullpen next year. Are we looking at Luke Maley more closely?
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's the next two-way player. We're sleeping on Luke Maley as a catcher slash pitcher.
Yeah, it's fun to see, and it obviously means things went well for the Blue Jays that Luke Maley was into that game. Again, they win that one 10-3, fun one all around. Caitlin, we've talked about it kind of all year, how the power isn't there. Sure seemed a lot more fun yesterday with the power going. Leo Jimenez, I know, gave you guys some comments after the game that seemed really light. What did you make of yesterday's game? How much did you enjoy? How much did those guys enjoy getting to have a game like that where the ball actually is leaving the yard?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously, you know, been an overall tough season for the Blue Jays, but I think it's nice when they have these games here and there where it's just a fun atmosphere. You give the crowd, you know, a good game to watch. The dugout is obviously very, you know, active and happy and energetic. You have George Springer going out there and hitting two. And, you know, it's been an up and down season for him, very tough at the start. So to see him kind of coming along is good. And then obviously, yeah, like some of the young guys getting into it. Spencer Horwitz having a great season overall. He gets one. Leo Jimenez has had a couple in the last few days, even though in between there he was kind of dealing with a sore knee thing. So that's good to see as well. I think that Leo Jimenez is one of those guys. John Schneider has mentioned it a couple times, like kind of got some sneaky power in there. Like maybe he doesn't look like a guy that can hit for much power, but does hit the ball quite hard. And so it's nice to see balls going out for him too. And yeah, I mean, just one of those good games where everybody was doing something at the plate. You know, the Blue Jays gave Jose Berríos and their bullpen a nice lead to deal with. So kind of just makes it kind of a relaxing game from the pitching end. And yeah, I mean, overall, it's been a good 24 hours, I guess, for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, it was nice. And I mean, yeah, pitching with a big lead must be a dream for these guys after how infrequently they've done it the last couple of years. Caitlin, since the trade deadline, the Jays are now 13th in weighted runs created plus, so a little above average at the plate. They are right in the middle of the league in home runs. Now, some of this is inflated because they hit five yesterday. I'm picking the arbitrary point of the trade deadline. It's only a couple weeks here. But more generally, when you look at what they've done offensively, and again, it's not a lot. They've scraped back to league average over the last couple of weeks here. What of that outside of Vlad's heater do you think is something that we should be looking at and that could have the potential to be relevant in 2025?
Yeah, I mean, some of that number is probably skewed also by Vlad because sure his run rated plus is like 300 since the trade deadline or something. I think that there's been some good signs from obviously the young players like Leo Jimenez, Spencer Horwitz, Wagner, obviously just been up a handful of games, but he obviously looks really great, getting the bat on the ball frequently. I think that Alejandro Kirk has been hitting the ball better, hitting it harder, obviously gets the home run yesterday, but I think just overall he's kind of looked better of late, and so that's probably something that you hope that can continue for the rest of the season. Maybe he ends the season strong. Maybe he can go into next year with that momentum. Because obviously I think his performance, maybe he kind of didn't get as much attention because some of the other guys with the bigger, with a bigger role in the team were struggling as well. So like, you know, Bo Bichette and Springer, everyone's paying attention to how they're performing at the start of the season. But Alejandro Kirk really, really started slow. It was not close to the level that we've seen him be in the past. And so I think him swinging the bat a little bit better is something that you hope that can continue into next year. And you hope that he can kind of, whatever he's unlocked lately, hope that he can carry that forward. Because, you know, especially with the Blue Jays, you know, I don't know. The catching market isn't very robust this offseason.
Nope.
I mean, one of the best guys out there is going to be Danny Jansen, and you don't know if he's going to want to come back or like, you know, what's going to happen there. You know, I think it's possible he comes back, but it's just, again, there's 29 other teams that might want Danny Jansen too, and there's not going to be a lot of catchers available. So you could be looking at a situation where Kirk is almost an everyday guy, and the Blue Jays I think believe that he can be that guy. I mean, he's had some periods with the Blue Jays where he has had to play a lot because of injuries to Danny Jansen. But I think that, yeah, if you can see him, you know, taking better swings and kind of thriving in an environment where he is kind of playing more. And in the past, he's kind of said he actually likes to play more often because he gets into more of a rhythm at the plate. So I would say, like, kind of watching what he does in the last 6 weeks is something that I'll be paying attention to. And yeah, if he can get on a roll, I think it's a positive sign for next year in the offense.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it holds up because, you know, he said that before, hey, I feel better at the plate when I'm in there every day. And then what we see in the numbers is after a couple weeks of playing every day, the numbers dip off probably because there's a fatigue element with playing catcher so much. So we'll see how that one shakes out. You mentioned Danny Jansen there. I was going to save this for later, but since the Danny Jansen topic came up, are you in Boston on Monday, and have you already started to pre-write the Danny Jansen becomes the first player to ever play for both teams in one game story?
I am not in Boston next week, so I'm going to leave that story to our Boston writer, Jen, who will probably do a great job on it. But I read the Jason Stark story that went up a couple days ago. Obviously, he went deep on it, just the whole phenomenon of suspended games and how wacky they can get. And yeah, I mean, people have been talking about this for weeks. I feel like it's the most anticipated game of the year for the Blue Jays for whatever reason. The one thing I didn't realize, and I was there, I was in Boston for that series that did for the suspended game. Like, I was there the last time they were there. And I actually didn't realize, just kind of forgot, Danny Jansen was at the plate.
So that
makes it even better. Like, I didn't even, I mean, it's one thing to sort of just be him being in a game for both teams, whatever. But I mean, the at bat, I mean, I think he was in the middle of the at bat. He has like two strikes or something like that. So I actually have to kind of look into deeper, like, I don't know if anyone's talked to John Schneider about it yet, but I mean, the amount of substitutions and things, like, it's going to get kind of wacky in that game, like, right off the bat.
It is. And, like, this is the thing is, yeah, he was down 0-1 in the count against Cutter Crawford. So this is, it's going to be fascinating because, like, not only could he play for the same team in the same game, he could play for the same team in the same plate appearance if they really want, because Reese McGuire was catching while Danny Jansen was at the plate, and Reese McGuire is in the minor leagues now. So they will need to change their catcher out. It's fascinating. This also, by the way, the AA New Hampshire team resumed a game yesterday that had been rained out like weeks ago, and they ran it. It wasn't, someone didn't play on both teams in that game, but it was funny to look at the box score and there were wholesale changes at like every roster spot in that one. So that should be fun. Caitlin, back to the power and the lineup side of it. Obviously, Danny Jansen was someone who brought that. We talked about some of those guys who are showing it now. This isn't going to carry over. They're not going to hit 5 home runs every game. But when you see a game like that, when you see the level that Vlad's hitting at lately, and we'll talk more about 2025 free agency and stuff like that, but what would look like a reasonable amount of power in this lineup next year? Like, I think back to 2021, where they had 7 guys hit 20-plus home runs and the catcher duo combined for 20. So effectively 8 spots in the order went 20-plus. Vlad and Semien had 40-plus that year. Maybe that's not repeatable. But just how much work is there to do to get back to where this lineup needs to be from a power hitting perspective? Because even the young guys who are up, like, a lot of those guys are like, oh, they could hit 15, not they could hit 30.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that you would get more out of Bo. I think that was one of the real curiosities about the season is how little power he hit for. I think he's at 4 home runs on the season. Obviously, he's missed a lot of time at this point, too. So you would hope that you could get at least 20 from him, assuming that he can come back healthy next year and get off to a better start, obviously. I think with George's 2 yesterday, he's what, at 16 now, 15, 16? So you would think that George still has at least 20 in him. Again, if he doesn't get off to as bad of a start as he got off to, like, I mean, he's basically just been hitting since June. So, you know, if you assume that he can, again, not have a 2-month slump at the start of this next season, maybe he has 20 in him still too. Vladdy probably has 40 plus in him. Again, we're talking about a guy that has basically been hitting his home run since June. He only had, I think, 5 or so by the end of May. So again, it was like, you know, for the whole start of the season, for the first 2 months of the season, it was like the Blue Jays weren't hitting for any power. So if you kind of go back and think, okay, like, let's just even out some of the power and give some guys some better starts there, you hope that you get a few more from the guys that I listed. Kirk probably has a little bit more power. I don't know that he's a 20 home run guy, but maybe he's a 15 home run guy. And then, yeah, like, guys like Leo Jimenez or Spencer Horwitz, how many do they have in them? Again, like you say, they're probably 15, but, you know, maybe 20 if they're having a good season. Where's Varsho at? Like, maybe a few. Does he have 20? Yeah, he has 20 or so, right? Like, so that's another 15, guy. Yeah. 15. Okay. So he can probably hit 20 or close to 20 by the end of the season. Looking up and down the roster, I don't see, like, you know, a ton more potential for power. So that's where obviously off-season moves have to come into play. And I guess the other one is Aurelvis Martinez. He's kind of a mystery at this point. We haven't seen him for so long. But I mean, obviously he's a guy that hit for a lot of power in the minor leagues, and that's kind of what he's known for, right? His power is his ability to get the ball out of the yard. So obviously some question marks now with him. Missing somewhat development time, getting suspended for performance enhancing drugs. So that is something that we'll have to kind of see next year, like what he can provide. But yeah, I mean, I do think there's a little bit more power in this lineup if guys are, you know, slumping for the first 2 months of the season. But also, you know, I think the offense probably needs a bit of an overhaul in the sense that I think you need to bring in at least two or so bats that can be kind of difference makers in this lineup.
Yeah, and even for the process over results crowd, you know, the Jays are bottom five in exit velocity and hard hit rate and things like that. So even if you're looking at the underlying things, they haven't done enough in that regard either. So a long way back there. Caitlin, he did not homer yesterday, but the Blue Jays had a new cleanup hitter in Will Wagner. I know you guys spoke to Will Wagner and to John Schneider about this pregame as well, that decision, and not even telling Will Wagner until the lineup card was out. Look, the batting order stuff is not all that important, obviously, at this point in the season. But what did you make of that and how Will Wagner handled it? And really more to the like bigger picture, John Schneider's explanation for why and why he wanted to kind of test Will Wagner in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's been hitting well, right? I don't exactly know what his numbers are, but it feels like he has at least a handful of hits every game that he's played this year. And so I think John Schneider kind of, the way that I took it is like, was almost like a little test. It was like, let me put him in the cleanup spot and see if he reacts or see what happens. And I think the good news was that he didn't have much of a reaction at all. He kind of just was like, all right, here we go. And so I think that's kind of the reaction that John Schneider said he was looking for. Like, he just wanted to make sure that he could handle it, and he's unfazed by the whole thing. And some of that probably goes back to having a major league dad. Obviously the Blue Jays are familiar with having guys that have grown up around major leaguers, grown up in the clubhouse, so to speak. And so, yeah, I mean, he just seems like a real kind of even-keeled guy. Again, does not seem fazed whatsoever. I mean, he's a little older. He's 26. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not like we're talking about a 21-year-old that's come up in the major leagues. I mean, he's kind of progressed through the minor leagues and spent a lot of time at AAA this year, kind of proved everything that he needed to prove at AAA. So I think he's done his time, and it's probably a matter of like him feeling like, no, I'm ready to be up here. Like, you know, this is the time that I should be up here. I've passed every test. I've checked every box that I need to check. And so, he just kind of looks like he is ready to be here. He kind of belongs here. And he's obviously done a very good job lately for the Blue Jays. And yeah, he looks like it's early. It's very, very early, but he's jumping towards the top of the list of some of the young guys that look like, you know, they could be pieces for next year.
So obviously, in terms of young guys who are getting auditions and things like that, there are some guys at AAA that you and I have talked about, that we've talked about on this show a bunch, that the Jays might want to get a look at some point. Rosters expand in September. A couple guys, Nathan Lucas, Jonathan, Class A, et cetera, et cetera. There's also the possibility that, you know, maybe it's a little tight timeline-wise, but it's only 10 days away. Bo Bichette could be the extra guy, right? What is the latest? I know we asked John Schneider about this the other day, but with respect to Bo Bichette and Jordan Romano, what is the latest on them as they work their way back? And would we maybe expect to see them, you know, just get even a couple games in here before the end of the season?
Yeah, I think the latest for Bo, I think Jordan Romano hasn't quite started throwing yet, although the last update was a couple days ago, and he was throwing basically like weighted balls against the wall. And it seemed like throwing was somewhat imminent, maybe just a few days away. So maybe by early next week, he's throwing again. And then obviously he has to kind of progress to a couple bullpen sessions, then some live BPs, then, you know, some rehab outing. So he's still probably a couple weeks away. I do think the Blue Jays feel as though there would be some value, even if he comes back in the last, maybe there's only 6 games left in season or something like that, maybe the final homestand. But if he gets out there and has, you know, 2 or 3 clean outings, can kind of just, leave the season on a high note or a positive note, kind of knows he's healthy, feeling good. So you don't go into the off season with as much uncertainty. You don't go into next year, which obviously is a big year for him, a platform year for him, with uncertainty. So I do think the Blue Jays feel like there is some value in trying to get him back, even if it's just for like a small handful of outings. Obviously they're not rushing him back, and there's no competitive need to have him back, but again, more for his peace of mind, I think. And I think the same could be said for Bo. I think that he's not yet running, I think, but he's hitting in cage and taking ground balls. And so running and kind of testing out the calf will be the next step for him. And again, I think it's the same sort of situation where it's like there's no competitive need or push to get him back. The Blue Jays are obviously just playing out the string here and you know, trying to achieve their own sort of internal goals at this point. So I think for him, again, if you could get into, you know, a handful of games at the end of the season and just kind of know that the leg feels good, the calf feels good, you can run, you feel healthy, and then you go into the off season kind of at least knowing you got back, you got healthy, you were feeling good at the end of the year, and you can kind of go into the off season with a little bit more peace of mind.
Yeah, I think that's an important note, is that, hey, you're the season opener in 2025 on March 27th is not your first game back after, you know, 9 months or whatever. I think is probably a helpful thing for those guys to have. Again, like you said, as long as they're not having to rush it to accomplish that, something that could be reasonably helpful. Kalen, I'm curious, this is a little like inside baseball, but the shift since the deadline that this team has had, where obviously the focus is not as much on wins and losses, it's on player development and what is relevant for 2025 and things like that. How are you finding it? How are you enjoying it? It's been obviously we'd all rather be covering a team that's headed for the playoffs, but it's been like a couple years of every game is so intense and every game matters so much. Are you enjoying a short-term vibe shift here?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different. I mean, after a couple seasons, as you say, in a row where you're kind of living and dying with every single game, with every single inning. And, you know, there's been in the past, like a lot of chaotic travel booking for me towards the end of the season, where you've got to be on every trip and you've got to kind of plan to be in multiple places for the postseason. You know, you've got multiple flight bookings and so many hotel bookings that you got to keep track of. So to not have to worry about that this year is nice, I will admit, especially as someone who kind of handles their own travel booking. Like, it's nice to not have to worry about that. And, you know, yes, I think it would be preferred that the Blue Jays were just, I mean, there's the other flip side of that is like they could do that. You could have meaningless games because they were just leading the division by so much. Obviously, that's not happening. It's not really happening for anyone this year. Actually, all the races are pretty tight. But yeah, I mean, it's just a different challenge. I think that it's nice to sort of not necessarily have to write on deadline every single game, or like, you know, worrying about what happens every single game and having to rely on that to tell your stories. And, you know, I'm working on a mailbag right now, so it's a little bit of a different flavor for each game this season. But yeah, I mean, different challenge, I think, just to keep readers engaged and keep the audience kind of tuning in. But yeah, I mean, a little bit more low-key than I'm used to at this time of year.
Well, I took a look at the mailbag submissions so far, and August 21st with the team 11 games out of the wild card position. Kalen, good luck. People are losing their damn minds in those mailbag questions. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, and yeah, best of luck with the mailbag. We'll see you at the park later this week.
Awesome, see you later.
Kalen McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all the great work over there. In addition to Caitlin's work, yeah, Jason Stark went pretty deep on this possibility that on Monday, Danny Jansen could be the first player to ever play for both teams in the same game. And technically, he could play for both teams in the same plate appearance because he was at the dish down 0-1 when the game was suspended. And Reese McGuire, who was catching for the Red Sox, is no longer on that major league roster. I mean, it's possible he could get called up by then. You know, things change quickly roster wise, but yeah, right now he's not on that roster. So someone's got to catch. May as well be Danny Jansen in a plate appearance started by Danny Jansen. Be a lot of fun. Also fun. World Baseball Classic announced the pools and locations for the 2026 World Baseball Classic, which is happening in early to mid March of that year. So not this coming season, but the following one. Canada drew into a pool with Puerto Rico, Cuba, Panama, and one team that is yet to qualify. They will be playing in San Juan, Puerto Rico, in March 6th to 11th is their pool play. So if you are looking way, way ahead to the 2026 WBC, which, why not? It's fun. The last one was incredible. I'm looking forward to Olympic baseball in 2028, but we'll get the WBC before then. So yeah, Canada is not in the I guess, tougher group with U.S. and Mexico, but no easy pools if you're Canada and you're trying to get out of that. Puerto Rico, Cuba, Panama, and a team TBD in San Juan. If they moved on, they would then play their quarterfinals in Houston. And then the semis and championship of that event are going to take place in Miami. So yeah, should be fun. The U.S. is in another pool. U.S. is in the Houston pool. They'll play with Mexico, Italy, and Great Britain. And then Miami also has a pool that includes Venezuela, the Dominican Republic, the Netherlands, and Israel. And then there's the Japan pool with Japan, Australia, Korea, and Czechia. And then there's one team to qualify for each of those still. So obviously very early to be talking about that and focusing on it, but it came down during the show. So I thought I would make mention because the World Baseball Classic rocks and Canada will be in it again in 2026. Let's take a break. Let's check in on how your fantasy teams are doing down the stretch here. We'll talk to Derek Van Riper of The Athletic of Rates and Barrels, but a little bit of late season strategy here. He's also a Brewers guy. We'll check in on that Brewers team, including Canadian Tyler Black, son of broadcaster Rod Black, who is back in the major leagues and maybe a path to some playing time there for the Brewers. We'll whip around baseball as well. And that podcast, Rates and Barrels, talked recently about what the 2025 offseason could look like for the Toronto Blue Jays. So let's talk a little bit about that as well. Derek Van Riper's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win last night 10-3 against the Reds, and it's a pretty damaging loss for the Reds. They have been hanging on, obviously, just teetering on the edge of being out of the wild card race. They came into that one 5.5 back. They had swept a series, then got swept, then won the opener against the Blue Jays, and their playoff odds were hanging around like 2%, 3%, 5.5 games out there, but they lose yesterday. A bunch of teams around them win in the standings as well. So they're now back to 6.5 out. Their playoff odds are down under 1%. It's a tough go for the Reds. They need to make up some ground right now. Elsewhere in that NL Central division, the Milwaukee Brewers, also in a race, but it's for the best record in the National League and the ability to get a bye through the first round of the playoffs. Let's see how Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, of Rates and Barrels, is feeling about them. Derek, how we doing, man? Good morning.
Doing great, Blake. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great hair day, too, by the way. Before we talk Brewers here, I did want to talk a little fantasy baseball stuff. Obviously, you guys at Rates and Barrels do a lot of fantasy stuff in addition to just general analysis. How are you feeling heading into the stretch run here? Like, if you're in a head-to-head league, we're bordering up on playoff time. Obviously, Roto League, you've got the four owners who aren't even checking their lineups anymore, and you're churning the waiver wire and things like that. How are you feeling?
Generally good. I've got a few teams that are contending at least to finish in the money. I don't know if this is going to be the best year of fantasy baseball I've ever had. I think 2021 was the year where I won like 5 out of my 10 leagues and cashed in a couple others. So I don't know if you could have a lot of seasons like that, but I feel pretty good overall. I'm avoiding the major late season injuries. That's sort of the key, right? When things are going well, it's avoiding those last couple of injuries, like, you know, Austin Riley being down for the season, Hunter Green going on the IL for the Reds. Like, those kinds of things are just critically important to avoid. It's all luck kind of at this point as far as avoiding injuries go. But my teams have been surprisingly healthy in the second half.
So you're saying on the team that I have, which is my big money keeper league that Eno also plays in and is dominating the league, having Austin Riley, Christian Yelich, and Zach Eflin may be a bad time ahead for me here these next couple weeks.
It might be difficult. The only silver lining is I think it becomes easier to stream pitching again off of the waiver wire at the end of the season, because the teams that sold at the trade deadline are bad. We start to get to the point where guys that have nagging injuries begin to get shut down, and it makes it easier to use kind of average or below average starters just to fill in some of those spaces. So I think as long as you keep grinding, you always have a shot. And I guess if I had to pick, would I rather have banged up hitters or banged up pitchers? It's probably banged up pitchers because of what the waiver wire brings.
So what are you looking for when you're streaming starters this late in the year? Like, obviously, if a team is playing against the White Sox, that's almost an auto stream. Like, even if you were Nick Nastrini of the White Sox pitching against the White Sox, like, you might get streamed. But outside of that obvious layup, what are you looking for when you're sorting through the probables?
Usually I'm looking for the lineups that have high K rates, especially over the last 30 days. We're looking for recent form. An example of a team that I maybe wasn't targeting to stream against earlier in the year that I would stream against now would be the Guardians. I mean, they're not doing damage the way they did earlier in the season. They're still a low strikeout team, but they're in that range where if you need ratios to still be good, in most cases you do if you're contending, I think you can throw average starters against Cleveland and live to tell the tale. But yeah, I'm looking for the high K rates. I'm looking for teams that are at the bottom of that WRC plus team leaderboard over the last 30 days. You know, the Rockies are still a doormat. The Angels are brutal. There's almost no power in that lineup right now. So they're a really soft target as well. The Pirates have been easy to throw just about anybody against. I think the A's are one of those teams that are a little bit tricky, but I don't really fear them. And I know Jake Berger has been going off lately, and the Marlins are giving a few guys new looks. But even with that, the Marlins are a team that I'm circling for almost any starter I can find to throw them at this point in the season.
So those are some good options. Yeah, I'm too conditioned to, it's Coors Field, where, like, even the Rockies at home. But, like, even the Rockies at home, like, it's pretty bleak, and they're striking out more than any team in baseball, and they, like, walk a comical rate. It's I think it's time, even in Coors. Okay, on the other end of that, and I know most deadlines have passed here, but how do you guys handle the innings load, guys? Like Garrett Crochet, who's maybe only starting 4 innings each time. Obviously, in a league with an innings cap for the season, that can be, you know, not the worst thing in the world, right? Like, if you're coming up on your innings cap and Garrett Crochet is only throwing 4 innings each time out, you know, maybe not a huge deal. But for other formats, for the predominant formats, a guy like that can be tough. Some of these guys on, you know, bad teams, even if you look at the Blue Jays, where they have veteran pitchers, you know, possibly a 6-man rotation at some point and a bunch of off days in September. How have you navigated that end of the starting pitching situation?
I think in roto leagues especially, wins tend to be really clustered. So unless you are winning in the wins category by a healthy margin, you really need to be aware of guys that are going to have shorter starts. Now, if it's a Tarek Skubal situation where there's extra rest between starts and he's still going to go 5+ and be win eligible, I don't think you have to make any sort of adjustment. But the Crochet example, and maybe Paul Skeens too, depending on what the Pirates actually do as they taper his workload down, those are two guys that could have zero win probability going into a start unless they do something unexpected, like throw an opener in front of those guys, which the White Sox haven't done for Crochet all year, and I don't think they'll start doing that. And I don't think the Pirates would do that to Paul Skeens either. I think from a simple, like, ticket sales perspective and viewing perspective, people watching the game want to know when Paul Skeens is going to pitch. So I start to taper the usage of those guys away if I can, but it's not always a luxury you have. Your next best option may also be projected for a similarly low number of innings or have a very low win probability. So then you have to balance out the possible boost in ratios and strikeouts against the low probability of a win from a lesser pitcher. It's a really hard dance to do.
Yeah, and I mean, the opener thing to steal some of your shorter stint starters a win is nice, but in general, the opener is obviously the bane of all of our existence as fantasy players, where, you know, hey, it doesn't, you got to be diligent, right? Like, there was a stretch there where you could have bought on Nick Martinez, who will pitch against the Blue Jays tonight, but he was doing like 4 inning stints out of the bullpen before he moved back in it. So he's not showing up on the probables. If you have him on your roster, you got to be very aware of which days he's coming in the openers. Is that just because he's pitching against the Blue Jays tonight? Is that a guy that you've bought on or believe in Nick Martinez being a little better over the last little while?
I get tripped up by back end starters in Cincinnati in particular because you can't use them at home. So then you have to wait till they go on the road and you have to like the matchup for them on the road. And Martinez in particular is a guy that has shown a pretty wide range of skills over the course of his career. So I've been slow to buy into him. As far as like ace type guys in Cincinnati go, I'm a little more aggressive with those pitchers because I think they're undervalued, right? I think we've seen over the years, going back at least as far as Johnny Cueto, they can have frontline starters that give you great ratios despite the park boosting homers, right? So I was all over Hunter Green to begin the year. I really like Nick Lodolo. I think he's still got maybe one more level he can reach if he stays healthy for a full season. But yeah, Nick Martinez is one of those guys that I am usually out on because I just don't trust those skills in that home park.
And a timely pull with Johnny Cueto, because he will get called up by the Los Angeles Angels tonight to start against the Royals. We just saw the Angels. The Jays were just there. They're here for 4. So we won't see Johnny Cueto because he's pitching tonight. And then obviously they're here Thursday to Sunday. But very cool to see Johnny Cueto back in the majors. Don't imagine it's going to go super well given what he looked like last time we saw him. But fun to see him still doing it at, I think, 38 years old, getting closer to 39 there. Okay, let's pivot. Let's talk about the Brewers, another team in that NL Central. You're obviously a Brewers guy. They are 21 games above 500. They have an 11.5 game lead in the division, and they're fighting for the best record in the NL and one of those buy spots. Despite all of that, when we look at a Fangraphs postseason odds or a Pecota at Baseball Prospectus postseason odds and things like that. They are behind Philly and Atlanta and the three teams in the NL West, the Dodgers, the Diamondbacks, and the Padres. What do you make of that, given the strength of the Brewers' season? And does that feel accurate to you that, yes, even though they've punched their ticket basically, you know, not mathematically clinched, but they've clinched their playoff berth here, that there's not a lot of at least model side belief in this Brewers team making a run?
It makes sense to me because I think, much like the Tampa Bay Rays and a typical good Rays season, these are teams that use their depth to do really well in the regular season. And when you boil down the roster to its absolute best parts for the postseason, it doesn't always project as well as the big payroll teams that we see often projected for 98 or 100 wins, right? So I kind of understand it. I think part of it, too, would be having a young player like Jackson Churio, who's played exceptionally well going back to June 1st, thinking about how young players are valued in projection systems, he's probably under-projected relative to what he's likely to do. You think about the way the pitching staff is assembled. Tobias Myers' projections probably are not great. So, you know, you have to decide, do you believe in the players that we've seen over the last 3 months being much better than their projection against top-level competition in October? And I think that still takes a leap of faith, even if you can explain it, even if you can rationalize it. So I think that's a big part of why the models tend to be low on the Brewers. They're probably a little low on the Guardians too, year in and year out, for a lot of the same reasons. They just don't have that high-end thump and some of the things that are more projectable that makes a team consistently a little bit better.
And then, of course, there's also the factor of if you were looking for upside in a playoff series, you might look at the guy who was an MVP candidate over the 73 games he was able to play this year in Christian Yelich, who in only 73 games had posted 3 wins above replacement, obviously was OPSing over 900. He is done for the year with another back issue. What is the fallout of this? Like, I mean, we can talk who's taking on the role and Blake Perkins and Tyler Black and things. I do want to talk about Tyler Black at some point, but I also, like, I asked someone about Christian Yelich early in the year, and it's because he was off to a hot start, and I, you know, an invested fantasy guy and someone who just, like, likes the Brewers and wants to see them do well. And I asked someone on the team side about it, and the way they said it to me was, like, have you ever heard of someone having had a bad back, like, past tense? It's no. Once you have a bad back, it's like the old Bill James, once you own a skill, once you own a bad back, that bad back is yours forever. What is the outlook with this, where the Brewers' best player, the star, the face of the franchise, you know, it's hard to project what his future is going to look like given the back issues?
Yeah, and I think even before it got worse, even before it became something that required surgery, and the procedure Yelich had was a discectomy. I don't know which specific disc or anything along those lines, but everything they're saying, at least right now, points to him being healthy for spring training, which gives you some reason for hope. I think the reasonable thing to do is consider that he is also going to be 33 years old next season. There was a multi-year question as to whether or not he was still that MVP caliber player, and I was as surprised as anybody that the production was this good this season. I didn't think anything like this on a per-game level was possible. I thought MVP Yelich was in the rearview mirror, but I also believed that he had the kind of skills as a hitter that were still going to age really well. And the thing that has surprised me all along with Christian Yelich, even as the power has been less reliable over the last, 4 or 5 seasons now, he still runs a lot. He had 21 steals in 73 games. For a guy that's had chronic back issues, that tells me that maybe these issues can get a little better with some surgery. I would have expected that part of his game to completely disappear. You think about him as a guy that's always done a good job tempering whiffs, drawing walks. So I think he'll age pretty gracefully, all things considered. But I'd be surprised if the power post-surgery even comes close to what he was doing this year, because that already looked like an outlier to me. We saw double-digit barrel rates from Christian Yelich during those MVP years. He's been in that 7, 8, 9% range of the time since. So I think, you know, if we're looking at him as a 2 or 3 war player for the time left for him in Milwaukee, that's fine. That's a good long-term outcome. And I think now we're at the point where the torch has been passed to Jackson Churio. The timing of Churio's arrival is almost perfect for the franchise, given where Yelich is in his point, this point in his career. And they've gone through this before with Ryan Braun being the superstar that dealt with the intercostal stuff, the thumb problems he was always dealing with. He had nagging injuries on top of the PED suspension and the things that caused him to age somewhat poorly. I think Yelich should age better than Braun overall as a player. So that bodes well for this franchise. But just having Chorio there already, having good outfield depth, having guys like Sal Frelick, Garrett Mitchell, guys that could still get a lot better in that position group, that also helps. And Blake Perkins has been a nice player for them. I think he's still probably more of like a long-term fourth outfielder, but that's an area on the roster and the organization where they have a lot of good depth right now.
So with respect to Chorio, the latest, at least betting odds, have Paul Skeens as a pretty good National League Rookie of the Year favorite. Now, once we actually see, you know, once voters actually dig in, maybe that skews a little bit more toward the position players. If Paul Skeens obviously has his workload limited the rest of the way, you know, are voters going to weigh, you know, 90, 100 innings the same way they weigh 550, 600 plate appearances? I don't know. When it comes to Chorio, where is your confidence level or excitement level that he could maybe catch Jackson Merrill as, you know, hey, if it's not Skeens, this is the National League Rookie of the Year conversation?
Yeah, it's right there. I mean, it could be 1A and 1B. I don't really know how voters are going to feel about Skeens. Like, if Skeens' season ends in mid-September and these next few starts are a little shorter, I think people are going to take what he's done and put it in the appropriate context. It's easy to look at what he's done and say, this is as good as any pitching performance we've seen from a rookie since probably Steven Strasburg. That was, almost 15 years ago now, I think. But it's on that level. I think the thing that works against Skeens is this is a loaded NL rookie class, because voting for Paul Skeens over Jackson Merrill or Jackson Chorio or even someone like Tyler Fitzgerald, who's been fantastic. He's a little older, but he's had a great season too. I think that's going to make this kind of fascinating. So even if Skeens ends up winning Rookie of the Year, I think it's going to be really close. Maybe one of the closest votes we've seen in a while, where there are three, four, or five possible deserving candidates on the NL side this year. But the way Chorio's played since June 1st, we're talking about a guy that's got a 139 WRC plus. It's a 308, 355, 509 line, 10 homers, 10 steals. The defense has been getting better over the course of the year as well. You know, on paper, it's ticking all the boxes that I think voters look for in a position player. So I think he's absolutely got a shot, even though it's going to be a tough battle.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, Shota Imanaga could siphon off some of those votes for the voters who can, you know, technically he's a rookie. Obviously, he's a different kind of rookie than the other ones we're talking about, but he could be in the mix there as well. I want to pivot elsewhere with the Brewers and talk about another rookie. Tyler Black is back up. He came up earlier in the year. It's a big deal here. I'm sure you saw the clip of his dad calling his first hit. His dad is a very well-known and well-liked broadcaster here named Rod Black. Tyler Black has been on the radar for fantasy players for a long time because he's got double-digit power and he stole, 60 bases in the minors 1 year. Is there a path to him getting enough playing time right now with the Brewers to be fantasy relevant? And then more long-term, are you a believer in Tyler Black as a guy?
Short term, I think it's tough because they're going to mix and match at that position. You know, between first base and DH, they've got Black, they've got Jake Bowers, Gary Sanchez moves over to that DH spot a lot. So it's probably more of like a semi-regular role, an ongoing competition. I think if you're in a really deep league, sure, there's enough categorical potential where you take the chance, but he's probably one of the last people on your roster. Well, I think Tyler Black's really interesting because what he seems to have is outstanding strike zone judgment. But what we know about AAA right now with the automated balls and strike system is the strike zone's very different. And the quality of the pitching is as far away from big league pitching as AAA has probably ever been. So I think those two things in conjunction have made it a difficult adjustment phase for Black so far. And tack on top of that, the difficulty of not just having an everyday role. They brought him up, played him briefly, sent him back down. It's kind of that semi-regular for them right now. I think 2025 looks pretty good because there's no guarantee Bowers is still there. They could give him another offseason to continue improving defensively at first base. Maybe he can earn a little more confidence and trust with his glove, and that would fortify his playing time a little bit. There's so many ways that Tyler Black could be a good fantasy player and a good real-life player. I wouldn't want to give up on that profile based on, you know, kind of an up-and-down stretch for him playing time-wise, where he may finish this regular season with fewer than 100 plate appearances. And to me, that's sort of a null result as far as what he can do against big league pitching.
And it'll be interesting, too, to even say, obviously, the Brewers are a good defensive team and they have guys in other spots, but, like, Black played everywhere on the diamond in the minor leagues. And I know the, you know, the scouting book is, like, Yeah, he's probably not. Probably shouldn't play center field at the major league level when you have the outfielders the Brewers do. But like, he's played some corner outfield and some third base, and I think he came up as a second baseman. So maybe some paths there. Last Brewers one for you. Jacob Mizorowski, one of the top prospect in their organization, got the bump to AAA a couple weeks ago. He's been kind of starting and coming out of the bullpen. Given where the Brewers are and where they're headed this year, you want to see him in the Brewers bullpen before the end of the year, and maybe sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I think they should bring him up like right now. I love the quality of the pitching staff. I think the bullpen's actually really good. It's finally getting healthy. It's nice to have both McGill and Devin Williams healthy at the same time. It gives them even more quality in the late innings. But Mizorowski's been working in shorter stints at AAA Nashville since getting promoted there. A lot of one and change, two inning outings. They have spaced those out a little bit, so it's hard to tell if they're actually keeping him in relief the rest of the season or if they were trying to limit innings for a little while and then kind of ramp back up at the end of the year. There's some world in which if they see him as a starter, he's their third or fourth best starter right now, and he would start a playoff game. So there's a lot of the possible outcomes, but in some fashion, I think they need Jacob Mizorowski on this team, because if they decide to go with some of the starters that have got them through the regular season, guys that might not turn the lineup over a third time in any sort of playoff matchup, Mizorowski's the kind of guy that can come in and give you two or three innings, get through the lineup one time, and then bridge the gap to that elite short relief unit.
Yeah, it's it would be fun to see. And yeah, obviously it raises the radar when a guy moves to the bullpen in the minors. It's like, okay, are they getting him used to it? Like, is it just a workload thing? Or are they trying to get him familiar with coming out of the pen so that the major league level in a playoff race is not the first time he does it? Quick pivot here. I know you guys on Rates and Barrels talked recently about, hey, what is 2025 going to look like for the AL East also-rans, the Red Sox, the Rays, and the Jays? Want to focus on the Jays since this is a Toronto show. What was that conversation like for our audience who didn't hear it? What do you think the 2025 outlook is for the Jays? That, you know, they have some pieces in place, but it feels like there's a lot of work to do this winter.
Yeah, our read from the outside looking in was that you still have the Vlad Bo core for a little bit longer, and before you decimate that core, you make one more attempt to win with that group. And part of our thinking was, when you look at the Blue Jays prospects right now, it's not a loaded system. It's not necessarily a bad system, but you don't have your next two obvious impact guys knocking on the door to take over everyday spots. And I think if you're in that position, you'd be hitting the button for a rebuild a little too early with the caliber of the big league roster that they have. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with Bo Bichette. I don't know if he's going to get back to being the guy we saw earlier in his career, or if this is some kind of beginning of a rapid decline fueled by some health issues. I can't make heads or tails of it just yet. It's going to take me an entire winter to break that down. I guess the options, though, are more than you think. Like, you could trade Bo. You could trade Lowe and try to do like a partial rebuild. Maybe you could do something similar to what the Reds did a couple seasons ago, not completely tear it down Orioles style, make a few sharp trades, turn it around a little faster, and be competitive a year or two into the future, as opposed to waiting 4+ years before you're actually contending again. But yeah, I think the lack of upper level prospects to us on the show seemed like a reason to keep going with what you have for one more year, because it's not a bad core. It just needs a little bit of help in free agency. Do you think they can land a big free agent this winter, though? Because if you can't, then you're kind of caught in the middle.
Right. And that was the story of the last offseason, and the story of Chris Bassett's comments this week is like, yeah, you put a lot of eggs in the Shohei Ohtani basket, and that free agent class was worse than this coming free agent class, you know, barring any extensions and stuff like that. So there are more plan Bs available to you this coming offseason, but I don't think you're getting Juan Soto. And that if you don't get Juan Soto, that means you're going to need to hit on like one free agent probably isn't enough when you're going to be a 70 win team, right? Even if you price back in some positive regression, like Anthony Santander would be nice, but you're probably asking Anthony Santander and what else, right?
100%. Yeah. If you're going to shop in that kind of second tier, and it's no disrespect at all to Anthony Santander, he's having a fantastic year and he's one of the more underrated power hitters, I think, in the league right now. You would need to have two or three impact guys, you know, 2-3 war players that fill in the gaps. And then you need a couple other things to go right. You know, you need Alejandro Kirk to hit a little bit more. You need the Bo bounce back. They've got paths to do it, but you're dreaming on a lot of things being different than they are right now. And I'm not sure what else in the organization would have to change to unlock that between now and the start of 2025?
Yeah, and that's other than the free agents, that's the biggest question this front office has to figure out right now. It should be doing it right now and then as well in the offseason. Derek, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. Keep up all the great work.
Thanks, Blake. Take care.
Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, host of the Rates and Barrels podcast with our pal Eno Saris and Trevor May and Bricciaroli. Really great stuff if you're a fantasy player and if not, because at this point in time with the information we have available to us and the way we talk about pitchers, fantasy analysis is baseball analysis, which is a helpful convergence and makes a show like theirs very, very useful. Okay, we are going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we will talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs. We'll talk to Madison Shipman of Blue Jays Central as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays, keep it going against the Reds. The rubber match tonight, 7:07. Yariel Rodriguez against Nick Martinez. The Angels are then here for four. We'll spend tomorrow setting you up for that one. Right now, let's ponder what would happen if the season had just started a month ago. Well, Jays still probably wouldn't be pretty good. Their offense would look a little better. Ben Clemens wrote about exactly this today at Fangraphs. He joins us now. Ben, how we doing, man?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Looks like you got a fresh haircut, fresh lineup on the sides, looking good. Okay.
Yeah.
How are things this time of year for you? Because I know you, in your role, you have to cast a wide net. You have to be aware of all 30 teams and what's going on, the five things you like and didn't like that come out on Fridays. You know, you're hitting the good teams and the bad teams. But are you starting to narrow the focus a little bit on the playoff relevant teams? Are you doing the opposite and focusing on the weird teams that have a bunch of oddities and things like that? What is your process like this time of year?
This year is a little different. I basically really wanted to watch the Olympics. I've been doing a lot of baseball stuff, so I looked a little bit less at baseball for like 2 weeks because we don't get these very often. Zoomed in on those and then let myself come back to what was interesting. So basically, if you've been interesting in the last 2 weeks, I've been paying attention because I like enforced myself a reset. And now I'm just kind of getting dialed into what's interesting. Like, largely, I'm looking at the playoff relevant teams, but also the White Sox, because it's like you can't look away. It's like driving past a car crash. You have to go stare.
They are 30-97. It's pretty remarkable. And you did a piece today, what if the season started a month ago? And there are a couple things that are like actually, relevant and guys trending in different directions and things like that. And it's like, oh, by the way, the White Sox would still be insanely bad as well. Before we get into the baseball specific stuff, big Olympic guy, what are like your sports? What were you focused most in on?
Oh, I'm a big track guy. Okay. I ran track growing up, and did decathlon a little bit. And so there's everything that's all the goofy track events I love, all the short burst sprints I love. The 1500 this year was like one of the greatest races I've ever seen. And I watch a lot of races when it comes to the Olympics. It's just, I just love it.
That's great. It was, obviously it was a lot of fun. And I spent the whole show, there's a TV off to the side here that you can't see on the shot. But yeah, that was on during the show to catch a bunch of that stuff. Okay, so you come back to baseball, and one of the first things you look at is, I want to see all the worst pitches that I miss. So you've been doing a series on what we call meatballs, basically based on, count and pitch type and location and things like that. You just served it up. What makes a meatball? Like, what qualifies as it? Obviously, if it's a 3-0, 85 mile an hour, like if it's a batting practice fastball, we can identify that. But it goes beyond just, hey, I grooved a strike to get a strike. What goes into this for you?
Yeah, so I think this is really hard to define. And so I let a model do it for me.
Okay.
I think that's the smart way to do these kinds of things, because I'm not good enough. I'd leave too much up to interpretation. I'm too fallible, as it were. So we have a model. There's a bunch of these public models that try to grade how good a pitch is. We have one. It's fine. It's about as good as the other public models. I'm not here to tell you that ours is better and that you should only use ours, but they're all about the same. And what they do is they look at every pitch and they use just a ton of regressions that I don't completely understand to look at how they compare to other pitches and how those pitches have done. The one we use is kind of like a waterfall. It's like, how likely is the batter to swing? If they don't swing, how likely is it to be called a strike? If they do swing, how likely are they to hit it? If they do hit it, how likely is it to be foul? And it just kind of like ticks down from there, going through all the possible options. It eventually gets to like, what types of contact do these pitches allow based on, you know, where they are, like similar pitches in the strike zone, in similar counts, similar shapes. So it considers basically everything about the pitch shape, release point, movement, everything about the velocity, and everything about the count and location, and tries to compare it to a bunch of pitches that have been thrown before. And what I did was basically say, I don't really care about the overall quality of the pitch. Like, the worst pitches in baseball are all just like obvious balls that might hit somebody, because nothing good can ever happen. The batter will never swing. It's only bad. Whereas like, you've watched a lot of baseball games where somebody throws a pitch and you're like, no, 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 no. And they foul it off and they take it. And you're like, yeah, okay, cool. Like it really goes both ways. And even like the most hittable pitches aren't obvious home runs. So I let the model define it. And it basically says it's pitches where hitters are likely to swing. So actually your 3-0 batting practice fastball is almost never a meatball in the model, because most batters don't swing. And it does take that into account.
Who was it the other night that was it Francisco Alvarez that won a game on a 3-0 green light?
Yeah.
Okay, it can swing more happen. Often.
Yeah, they should. I mean, they should. The model can only look at what people have actually done.
Yeah.
And it says people let these go by too often. But, you know, in counts where someone's likely to swing, 3-1, let's say, when you're like much more looking for a fastball, 2-2. If you throw a batting practice fastball on 2-2, you deserve to have them hit a home run. And the model will pay attention to that. But it's just looking for these pitches where somebody throws it and you go like, oh, like that's going to be a home run. And I've been curious how frequently it actually becomes a home run. The answer is not very often, but it is a good test in that I looked at the 50 pitches that were most, the 500 pitches that were most likely to be home runs. And about 4% of them turned into home runs last week.
So a little higher than the average home run rate. Yeah.
Yeah. The average home run rate's like in the 1% range.
Okay.
Per pitch. And so like, it really does work. Like, this model is basically just identifying bad pitches, and mostly bad fastballs. So this is like, I think the most interesting broad picture takeaway from it is that bad breaking balls aren't as bad as I thought, because they just still move, and they're batters just don't hit them for home runs as often as bad fastballs. Bad fastballs, they've just been hitting their whole lives.
Right.
Like, I understand that you look at a bad breaking ball and you're like, it didn't break, but it still moved differently than a fastball. And just a bad fastball that looks like a batting practice pitch, those get hammered.
It's also, I'd imagine there's an element too, if you're a hitter, like if you knew this was what was coming, yes, every major league caliber hitter would tee off on these, but you have to be able to identify them. And like, I know something that you look at, and I think this came up in your Jack Centurio piece recently, is, you know, what do you do with those bad breaking balls? And the leaderboard for who damages those lines up really, really well with the best hitters in baseball. It's like Vlad and Aaron Judge and Yordan Alvarez and guys like that. So that's obviously a skill as well, being able to jump on that hung breaking ball. Yes. But it's a tougher skill than here's a BP fastball. Okay, so I wanted to ask on the pitching side of this, because I was doing a pregame thing on Justin Steele on the weekend because the Jays faced him.
Yeah.
And he's second, and this isn't meatballs. This is just fastballs located over the heart of the plate. He was second in the majors in those. Now, Justin Steele is Mr. Deception, and my arm angle's different, and I gyro spin the fastball instead of backspin the fastball. Tough guy to figure out. He allows some damage on those, but not a ton. But in looking at the leaderboards, Kevin Gausman throws the fastball over the heart of the plate more than any pitcher in baseball this year. Does that to you, like, does that suggest a command issue to you, like a guy not able to locate it on the edge? Is it, you know, I guess just what do you think of that? And then I know you have some stuff on Gausman's home run numbers this year as well, generally.
Yeah, I think actually Gausman and Steele is a good example of something, two places I've looked, one that looks fruitful, one that doesn't, for how these bad pitches translate into home runs. So the first thing I thought when I was doing all this research was it's a number of pitches thing. Like if you throw five pitches, batters are less likely to be able to pounce on your bad ones. And so just the more stuff you can do, the more you'll be immune to this. And so I was like, well, Gausman doesn't, right? Like he's a two pitch guy, maybe two and a half if you're being charitable. So he's going to do worse than expected on these. And I think that's basically true that, you know, he gives up a fair amount of home runs. That's just a part of his game. I mean, partially that's because his primary pitch is a fly ball pitch and he throws it down the middle, but like he's not getting away with it. Like yeah. He's giving up the amount of home runs you'd expect for particularly this year, but even last year, like for the kind of guy who does this, he's giving up the damage you'd expect him to. But then Justin Steele also only throws two pitches. Like he's not that different and it doesn't seem to bite him nearly as much. So, okay, number of pitches kind of got thrown out as I investigated it more because it doesn't seem like it's enough. Like there's just more stuff that matters than how many different pitches you throw. But one thing that the meatball research does really well, I think, is that it looks at Justin Steele's fastball and it says, well, like batters don't actually hit pitches like this for home runs that frequently because they're weird. Like you said, he's just doing a lot of weird stuff. Like the ball spins weird. It's it comes out of his hand strangely. And that doesn't, like, it is not a great pitch, but it plays above what you'd expect watching at home because it's just a little off. One of my old colleagues, Kevin Goldstein, wrote, and, you know, he's a scout. He's worked in baseball for a long time, and he always had trouble mathematically quantifying this, but he wrote about what he calls the line of normality. And it's like if your fastball has about as much like arm side run and rise, like the two movements you can impart on it when you throw a fastball. If it's about 45 degrees on that line, it's just going to get hammered. And particularly when you put it in a bad location with bad velocity on that line, like normal movement, it's just going to get obliterated because hitters' eyes are just so used to tracking that pitch, just tracking that shape for their entire careers. Everyone throws four seamers growing up, you know, like yeah. Sinkers are like, whatever. That's more of an advanced tactic. Every baseball player has seen far more four seamers than anything else. And so if yours looks like all the pitches they saw throughout Little League and high school and college, and it's located badly, it's going to get hurt a lot. And so the way that Steele avoids that is because his just doesn't. It's strange. Like it's not popping the radar gun and often it's badly located. But it just gives hitters that split second of like, oh, like I think this ball's going to go higher, and they miss it a little bit. This year, a little bit less, but he's frequently been a pretty good ground ball guy as a result, just because they're kind of looking for seam, even though, you know, you go to the scouting report and it's like he throws a cutter, like the ball's going to cut. It's not going to rise. And it's like, OK, I got it. And then you see it. And your brain's like, it's going to rise. So I think that's a lot of it is just being strange. That's one thing that I think the model and I have concurred on for like pitches that aren't as meatball-y as you think, it's the weird ones. And for guys that get hurt more than you expect, it's the Gausman-y guys who, like, when they do it their way, it's really stand out. But the bad ones, because he's like the normal fastball, but more, right? Like everything's a little more. It's got a little more spin. It's a little better located when he's hitting. He throws a lot of fastballs, so he's going to be in the middle a lot. But it's got a lot of ride and it's got a lot of velocity and he amps up the velocity in big counts. He's basically trying to succeed by taking the fastball that everyone throws and doing it better. And it mostly works. Like, it's a good pitcher. But when it doesn't work, that's why he's so susceptible, I think.
Well, you look at the distribution of the fastballs he throws, right? And even if on average his fastball is going to be better than those ones, there's going to be a tail of that, I don't know, one standard deviation or whatever, of normal-looking fastballs. And it sounds like the worst thing you can throw is an average fastball construction-wise.
Exactly.
So on the hitter side, obviously we can look at the leaderboards, your womps, as it were, and it lines up pretty well with who you think are the best hitters. And like, obviously it's an oversimplification to be like, well, to be a good hitter, you've got to take advantage of the mistakes that you're given. But you mentioned it, like only 4% of these really bad pitches get hit for home runs. Hitting is really, really hard. So is it fair to generalize that, like, if you are a hitter who is not able to take advantage of those, you're probably, you know, you're definitely leaving something on the table, but it's like a yellow flag maybe if you're a hitter type who's not able to, you know, jump on those kind of mistakes.
I would say that if you cannot jump on those kinds of mistakes, you need to have a different thing. Like, don't try to just be a garden variety, like I'm going to try to hit some home runs and accept some strikeouts if you're not punishing those pitches. I think the guys who I think look the worst when I consider this model are the guys who you and I would consider sluggers, but who aren't doing this. Mm. Like, you can opt out of this. Davis Schneider, I mean, he's been very cold recently, but he's an example of a guy who I would not probably try to analyze by this metric. Isaac Paredes, you know, speaking of the Cubs, similar idea. But Luis Arraez, like, there's just like a lot of, I mean, Luis Arraez is like a little bit of a cheat here because he's just so strange. But Mookie Betts doesn't show up incredibly well. Like, you can succeed without doing this thing. But what I would say is if you're trying to just be a, like, if you're trying to be a home run hitter and in the kind of Vlad Guerrero, just get to a lot of power in the air and just hit the ball really hard and let the chips fall where they may kind of way, like, you really need to be taking advantage of this. And I think Vlad is a great example because in 22 and 23, he wasn't. He was hitting too many ground balls on these. And it, because his game is so geared to like just hit a bunch of homers and like take these big swings and like use his very good talent with the primary goal being doing damage in the air, he needed to cash these in. And so when he's not, it's not working. And when he is, it really works because you get these pitches. Like, very few pitchers don't throw a lot of hittable pitches. That's how it works. And they get by because, yeah, like you said, baseball's hard. But Vlad is going to get crushable pitches. Aaron Judge gets crushable pitches, even though, like, you know, obviously what you tell your pitchers before the game is like, let anyone else beat us. But pitchers aren't that precise.
Also, sometimes people intentionally walk Juan Soto to face Aaron Judge and then like throw him pitches outside the zone that he hammered. Like, yeah, pitching is really difficult. Like, the reason you get meatballs is because it's hard to be precise on the outside edge. You're going to get some.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say if you're looking at a guy who's, what he's doing is hitting the ball hard. He's not trying to pull and lift. Like, those guys can be kind of weird. Jose Bautista was never a like maximum like barrels kind of guy. He was just really good at lifting the ball to his pull side. And he was obviously a fearsome power hitter, but he knew that he wasn't going to just be smashing everything 115 miles an hour in the gaps. So he tried to like max out on what he could do. And that's what I would say. If you're one of these guys who just has effortless power when you get into one and doesn't swing and miss too often, cool. like great. Just try to do that. Try to put the ball in the air and, you know, keep doing what you're doing. But if you're not, don't try to be on this. Like, do something else, because there are other ways to succeed as hitters. You can be, you know, a gap to gap guy. You can have really good plate discipline. Stephen Kwan is a great hitter who will never be on like the top of these leaderboards. He just really knows what his thing is and leans into it. So that's what I'd say. If you're great at this, cool. But if you're not, like, don't try to be a bad version of it.
Yeah, that's and I think that makes sense. That's it's got to be you. You got to do what's in your skill set. Okay, I want to talk a little relief pitching. And this is something you and I talked about a little bit heading into the trade deadline, because, you know, trying to get a read on, hey, these relievers are better over half a season than they were last year. What do you pay for that? You know, it turns out the answer is, well, we're like, every winning team is just going to trade for two or three relievers and see what sticks. Like, AJ Preller is like, I don't know who's good. I'll just get them all at once. And we'll see there. When it comes to this late season window here, and this is more of a Jays question, like, obviously the teams that are in the playoff race, you know, that's focused on the playoff race. You're pitching the guys who can pitch in leverage and things like that. But if you are a team like the Blue Jays that right now has, I don't know, 22 quad A relievers on their 40 man because they've spent the entire month of August claiming guys off the waiver wire and optioning them down, what are you looking for? Like, what is relevant when all we ever get with relievers is small samples? What are we looking for here?
Yeah. So one thing that seems to be the case is that you're probably not going to have a lot of proven types, because that was what everyone wanted this deadline, right? Like, the big premiums were for guys who had done it for two straight years. And so with the exception of Chad Green, which kind of surprised me, but he's around for next year. So in either case, like, that was a very common trope. And so if you're not in the playoffs, you probably don't have a lot of those guys. So yeah, what you're not looking for is someone to just repeat like their what they've been doing for years and years, because that guy's not on your team. So you got to find something new. You got to figure out something that you can look for that does not fit those. And the first place that I would go, if I were a team, is looking for something that the pitcher does that's interesting. It doesn't need to be like a great fastball, but it probably will be. It'll probably be like a great fastball or a great breaking ball to kind of be a standout guy. And two things. One is that they're like absolutely putting up crazy strikeout numbers, but walking too many or giving up too many home runs, and that's holding them back. Okay, so I'd be very interested in those kinds of guys, because like that sounds like something where one thing could click and really change what's going. And the second thing I'd be looking for is guys who have like a really nasty pitch and can't integrate it into the whole thing. So I'm trying to think of a good Blue Jays-centric example here.
Yeah, I'll give you two based off what you just said. Yeah. So Tommy Nantz is a guy. He's only thrown six innings for them now, but big curveball. Team loves this curveball, thinks they could get it. Now, the pitch modeling metrics don't like it as I shouldn't say they don't like it. They're split on whether the curveball is really good. Stuff Plus loves it. Pitching Bot at Fangraphs really doesn't like it. I don't know how that comes out in the wash, but the Jays love the curveball. The pitch metrics love the curveball for Tommy Nantz. He hasn't had the results. He hasn't had much sample in the major leagues. So that's the type of guy that, at least you could understand why we're going to get more out of the curveball. The other one would be Brandon Little, who walks too many guys and allows too many home runs, but has the best ground ball rate in the league.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like something like that. Actually, Tommy Nantz is a great example. Both of our models love it.
I might have looked in the wrong spot.
Pitching Bot thinks it's the best curveball in baseball.
My leaderboard flipped upside down then.
Yeah, 78 on the 20 to 80 scale. So that's pretty good. That's a good example. He's a great example. That kind of thing. 78? Like a pitch where you go. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it doesn't work great at the extremes because it's just like it can't handle it. It's done in standard deviation, so it gets weird.
Yes.
But that's a good example. Looks like Trevor Richards, Trevor Richards, good pitcher.
Yeah.
Nothing surprising there. That's why he got traded. They like his, they like all of his stuff a lot as well. Look for guys like that and give them a chance. One thing that is increasingly tough in the analyst role relative to the team role is they have their own version of this, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not like telling tales out of school here. Every team has some version of like, look at the pitches and tell me what's good, and let's see if we can tinker with it. That ship has sailed that I can just like pick up low hanging fruit on the internet at home and tell teams things they don't know. This is like one of the most important things to do is like find a weird thing that could work. Not weird necessarily. Just find what your guys do best. And see if we can tilt it a little around more towards that best, or like see if we can find a way to use that good thing to minimize their weaknesses. So like Nantz is a good example. He's kind of sinker curveball, but he throws a slider. Like maybe they're going to say, I don't know, your sinker and slider are getting hit more than they should. So let's like reweight it to be mostly curveball, 50% curveball and a quarter of the other two pitches. Or like, hey, we've noticed that your curveball is a lot better when you're throwing it in the zone. And because of the way that you've been using it, because you're using it as a secondary, you throw a lot more chase pitches. But let's like mix it in earlier in the count a little bit, try to like bend it two ways. The best thing you do is manipulate a curveball. Let's like try to make two curveballs out of that so we can do more things with it. If I'm a pitching coach, if I'm in the front office on a team, if I'm in the whole pitching strategy group, this is what I'm looking for. Like, what's a thing you do that is very good, like very good? And ground ball rate's a great example. One great pitch is a great example. Okay, look, the games don't really count for the next 2 months. Let's make this thing work. Like, let's find a way to make this thing work. And I think what you said is right, that it's smart what they've done of spending all of August like getting a bunch of these different guys on the team, because you don't need a lot of these to stick to have a pretty good bullpen. If you look at the way that like the Yankees have been built, I mean, this year hasn't really worked out for them, but for years and years, what they would do is teach guys to throw harder in the minors. And then, you know, if four of those 12 that they taught to throw harder worked out as good relievers, then they had a great bullpen. And that plan is a good plan because you don't want to do the other thing. You don't want to be AJ Preller and say, I don't know which of these guys works, so I'm going to go pay a ton for Tanner Scott, but then also like trade for some other relievers. I think I would much prefer to be getting the relievers when I have a disappointing year and working with them, saying, let's figure out how to get you better. That'll get you paid. It'll get us better. Everyone wins. Let's figure this out. And then do that in the minors and in the majors when your team has a down year. And if you land on just a few guys, that's going to save you a ton in the future. So this is a great chance for them to do that. If I'm the Jays, I'm still trying to be great next year. And honestly, I'm trying to sign Vlad to a long-term extension. Or Bo Bichette. I go back and forth now because their fortunes have really diverged and you gotta follow the numbers. If I'm building for the long term, the best thing I can do in the next 2 months is, find three relievers who I can use in the middle and late innings.
Yeah, and none of them are going to be guys that you're going to come in. There's not enough time left for anyone to do anything where 2025 you come in and fans are like, oh, yeah, I trust that guy. But you have I exaggerated earlier, but I just looked at they have 15 relievers on the 40-man right now, and none of them are prospects. It's all Tommy Nance, Ryan Burr, Luis Frias, who'd they pick up the other day, Easton Lucas. It's just throwing stuff against, and more than half of those guys will get non-tendered or DFA'd by the time Rule 5 rolls around. But if a couple of those guys can stick, because even as a team that has spent as a top 8 payroll the last couple of years, paying for relievers in free agency is the least efficient way you can spend your money. And then I guess the other thing is the other way to do it via trade, the Preller route is, and I did want to ask you this hypothetical. The Jays have a lot of guys right now who are getting regular playing time as position players who are probably better cast as bench guys next year. And some of those guys then would either be out of options or would become AAA depth. Is that a way you could address the bullpen, seventh, eighth inning? One of those guys misses out on, let's say, we'll use Addison Barger as an example. A prospect, but not a top 100 prospect. Let's say he loses out the bench role to Will Wagner and Joey Loprofito. He could go down to AAA and be depth, but they could also probably get a seventh, eighth inning guy from him, especially from a second division team who could use the bat. Is that too low value? Is that too much value lost in a trade, even if you have a hole in a bullpen, to address the bullpen that way?
I don't think so in the Jays context, because they do pretty well at finding these kind of utility guys to fill those holes. Like you said, they just have a logjam right now. He could lose out to Wagner and Loprofito easily, with nothing weird going on. But B, I think that organizations do have strengths overall in the long run. And it seems to me that one of the Jays' strengths is they're pretty good at figuring out these kind of middle infield guys. They've just had a variety of them that have worked out, that they've managed to get value out of in trading. Santiago Espinal was great for years and they got something out of him. Kevin Biggio, he was very acceptable for years and they traded him in the end.
Way to describe Kevin Biggio.
I always wanted him to be better. He was a great example of a guy who had the skill sets of the power hitter, where if he was crushing the ball when given good pitches to drive, he'd be awesome. And he was trying to be that guy and he didn't have it. And it just you always were if he puts this together, and he just never did. He's a player who, getting wrong for me, because I was consistently higher on him than he ended up, helped me learn where the blind spots of my analysis are. And you can't just look for guys who look like Juan Soto, because Juan Soto does a lot of things well, and doing half of them well is not enough. I think given a strength for developing these kinds of guys, again, I think it's pretty inarguable that Jays have that. You should be looking to trade those for something that you're not as good at developing. And I think reliever is a good example of that. No team can ever develop enough relievers, but particularly in the Jays' circumstances where they've traded away a lot of their more established guys, or things just aren't working well for the more established guys, hey, that's a good time to kind of try to convert an excess into a lack. So I wouldn't do this every time, right? Hitters are likely to give more value in the long run. And there is value to having four bench guys and maybe one of them takes a step forward. But it's diminishing as you add guys. Having a second guy and having a competition between two, very valuable. Having a third guy and having a competition between three, it's still good. The fourth guy, you're losing some juice there. It's just how likely is he to beat out everybody? A lot less than how likely is he to beat out one guy. It's the whole, like, if you're five back in a wild card race, okay. But if you're five back with six teams in front of you, yes. Yeah, it's over.
Yeah, the Cincinnati Reds issue right now.
Exactly. I think Barger is kind of in that spot where, like, yeah, hey, he could get better. But obviously, like, that happens to players all the time. But he just needs to get better and also not have the guys in front of him get better.
He needs to get better, more better than Will Wagner gets better and Jopy Loperfido gets better. And I just use Barger as the example.
Yeah, but agreed. Yeah, so I think that makes sense. Like, he could use more playing time somewhere to see what works out here. And I would be completely happy doing that trade. I think it's a loss in a vacuum. Like, right. If you did that trade 100 times, like, don't. You're losing. But given the shape of things, it kind of makes sense. Because, like, yes, he is more valuable than a random seventh inning guy, but they're wasting that value.
Right.
Because of the other players they have.
All right. Yeah. And that's, you know, obviously it's a little early to work through those, hey, 40 man juggling trades and things like that. But when you get asked, like, hey, why are we talking about Tommy Nance? Well, this is why. This is why. Yes. Ben Clements of Fangraphs, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Blake.
Ben Clements of Fangraphs. Make sure you're checking out all his great work over there. Everyone's great work over at Fangraphs. This is half the Fangraphs show and half the Baseball Perspective show some days. We're going to take a break, though, and we're going to talk Blue Jays Central show. We're going to talk to Madison Shipman on the other side about the five home runs the Blue Jays hit last night and if they can keep it rolling tonight against Nick Martinez. Madison Shipman joins us next as Jays Talk Plus rolls on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays hit five homers last night. A lot of focus on guys who could maybe make a case for a bench role next year, playing out the string here. It's audition time for a lot of these guys. Let's see how Madison Shipman is feeling about them. She is of Sportsnet on Blue Jays Central for this series. But Madison, before we talk about the power, Luke Maley threw two innings last night. Have you ever been in a game situation where you were worried maybe you were going to get asked to pitch?
No, I have never been a spot where I was going to be asked to pitch. Thank goodness for my teammates, because if I was out there having to pitch, then I probably would have been throwing even slower than Maley was throwing last night. Although that 41 mile per hour knuckleball, is it that he was throwing, or slider, whatever they were calling it, it seemed to kind of fool a few of those Blue Jays batters. But no, it's funny when you looked at him walking off the field too, just that slight little smirk that he had, knowing that they weren't able to get anything off of him.
Two perfect innings for Luke Maley. And Madison, you're downplaying it a little bit. The real reason you wouldn't get asked to pitch is that's for the backup catcher or the utility infielder, not the star shortstop. That's why you don't get asked to pitch.
Well, if I was able to go out there on the mound and throw overhand, maybe I would have had a chance. But me pitching underhand, there was no chance that I was going to be anywhere close to the strike zone.
So here's a pivot. Carson Spires may as well have been pitching underhand yesterday. He gives up five home runs, 10 runs, 9 earned, 13 hits, 5 homers over his 4 1/3 inning. Obviously, it's fun that the Jays did this. They jumped all over him. What did you say? I know he was in a bad spot too. The Reds just, like, needed him to eat innings because they'd had the emergency call up the day before. Nick Martinez, who's throwing today, is a converted reliever. So Spires wasn't put in the best of spots. But what did you see from him from a mistake standpoint and just kind of, yeah, he threw batting practice yesterday?
Yeah, it just felt like there were a lot of pitches that he was throwing that, quite frankly, were just missing over the middle of the plate. And when you look at the Reds and even some of the games that they've played recently, I felt like even in his past couple of outings for the Reds, maybe the numbers weren't really indicative of his performance, just because the defense maybe not helping him out a little bit. And you saw some of that last night, too, even in the first inning. I believe it was Dalton Varsho that ended up hitting that triple out to center field. That when you look at it, maybe TJ Friedl probably should have caught that ball out in center field, but what that does for the Blue Jays on the flip side is it continues to give them a little bit of momentum that they're seeing the ball well off of him. And when you do that, you almost feel like you're in control of the at-bats with a pitcher out there. And it just felt like he was just throwing exactly to the spots that they wanted him to throw it at. And, you know, with George Springer having his two home run night too, jumping all over a sweeper in the second inning, he had struggled a bit game one against the Reds, primarily against fastballs. And I love the adjustment from him saying, you know what, well, if I'm not going to hit the fastball, there are some other pitches that I can hit. And he went up there, got the sweeper for the home run in the second inning. And then I believe it was a changeup that he hit in the fifth inning. So all over some of those off-speed pitches, those breaking balls. But it was really nice to see the production from the Blue Jays top to bottom, too. And Vladdy even had a couple of hits in there, but you weren't relying on Vladdy to hit a home run every single time. So it was nice to see even some of those other guys, too, that I would categorize more as your contact type of hitters in the Blue Jays lineup come through with that power, whether it's Alejandro Kirk or Spencer Horwitz or Leo Jimenez, two guys that typically you think of more as gap-to-gap type of hitters. But for them to square up something and drive it deep out of the ballpark, it was definitely a fun one to be a part of. Selfishly, I was hoping that one of those home run balls was going to make it all the way up into the studio set. There have been a couple that have been close. I will say Vladdy's that he hit game one of this series definitely had the height on it. It just wasn't quite in our direction. But maybe at some point during the rest of the season, one of those home run balls can make it up onto our set.
Yeah, I just hope you guys are locked in for it. You know, that's it's going to be a hard hit ball if it makes it up to 243 there. With respect to George Springer, you mentioned it. He hit a couple yesterday. He had been struggling with the fastball a little bit. Obviously, his season has been, you know, the really big struggle to start the year. Then that really great hot streak that he went on for a little while. And then over the last couple weeks, he'd been like quietly pretty cold again. He was hitting like .167 over his last 20 games or so. Only had one home run in that stretch. Now, the last couple games, he's hitting a little bit again. Is this like, are you seeing anything underneath there? Or is this a case of, you know, the guy's about to turn 35. Maybe we're at the point in the career where he's going to be a little streakier because he might lose something and then have to refigure it out.
Yeah, I think at this point, too, you know, we talked about how I mentioned that he didn't really hit the fastballs well in game one, and so he adjusted in game two. I think that's where you're starting to see the streakiness a little bit from him this season, primarily with that fastball. When you think back to June and July when he was getting on those hitting streaks, it was because he was able to be on time for those pitches again. And I felt like in game one especially, he was getting a lot of those fastballs caught in on his hands. He made that mechanical tweak earlier in the year that seemed to get his bat on plane a little bit quicker so that he could get those fastballs just a little bit further out in front when he's making contact. That would be an area that I try to focus on the rest of the season, is trying to get back to being on time for those fastballs. I think you saw an example of the veteran player that he is by going after different pitches last night, and knowing that you've got a team that, like you mentioned, has been dealing with some injuries in the starting rotation. They're trying to figure things out. The Reds are still hoping to be in a playoff run here down the stretch of the season, but they've got that pitcher out there, Spires out there, struggling a little bit, throwing in a couple of those breaking balls, and take advantage of it. If they're going to throw it to you and that's something that you're seeing well, go ahead and go after it. But that's where you're starting to see those numbers dip down just a little bit. And I think it's because of the results, or the results that he has not been getting against those fastballs, just quite frankly, not being on time and getting a little bit too handcuffed on those swings on the fastballs.
So elsewhere, Leo Jimenez, he's a guy you and I talked about last time you were on the show with me. And I know you like a lot of what he does at the plate. He's had three homers in the six games since we last talked, Madison. Not a guy that had a ton of power in his minor league profile, had showed it a little bit more this year, but eight home runs over 94 games last year. And that had been a minor league high for him. What are you seeing from Leo Jimenez to get into a little bit more of the power?
You know, the one thing that you and I had talked about just a few weeks ago was just how much I liked the fundamentals of his swing. And it's his ability to stay inside of the baseball. And what that allows him to do is, one, you can make your swing decisions just a little bit later because that barrel's staying behind just a split second longer. But also, when you do make contact, because your hands are out in front of your barrel, that baseball is staying on the barrel for an extremely long time through the zone. So for him, I think it was just about finding those pitches that he could drive with power, but also I find that his strengths can also be gap to gap. So every once in a while, you're going to run into some of those pitches where it just feels really good off of the bat, but it all starts with those solid fundamentals. And the fact that he's able to hit a variety of different pitches and different speeds just purely based off of the fact that he's able to keep his hands inside the baseball so well, those are the types of things that I was looking for immediately when he got called up. And the first couple of swings that I saw I thought, okay, this is somebody that can really do well just because he's able to keep his hands inside the baseball so well. And now he's finding pitches that he can't, he's not going to just hit out into the outfield, but pitches that he's going to hit with authority, seeing him being a little bit more comfortable in the box too. And so it's really cool to see him show off some of that power, but that swing, him, all of his swings, I could watch those swings all day long. And maybe it's coming from a place of, I never could quite get my hands inside the ball as well as Leo Jimenez does. So maybe it's a bit of jealousy on my part with his hands going through the zone. But that is just such a sweet swing. And for him to be able to tack onto the home run party last night with that home run that he hit in the fifth off of a sinker, I believe it was. Really fun to be able to watch him take some cuts up there at the plate.
Yeah, and it was just a fun one in general. He's having a blast in the dugout and fun quotes after the game. I'm going to turn this negative for one question, though. Someone who didn't get in on that because he wasn't starting and he really hasn't been playing much against right-handed pitchers of late is Davis Schneider. I know two nights ago he came in as a pinch hitter and he got jobbed with a couple tough called strikes. Last night he comes in, just goes 0-for-1. His batting average on the season now is down below 200. His OPS comes in at 641. When he has been playing, what have you been seeing with Davis Schneider at the plate?
Yeah, there's been a couple of times, too, where I find that it's almost like maybe he's going up there in a certain at-bat and trying to get a feel for a couple of pitches, maybe watch a couple of pitches go by, and those ended up being some of the pitches that you would think that he'd want to go after early in the count. And then on the flip side, you have some other at-bats where he's going up there being very aggressive early in the count. And his sweet spot's going to be low in the zone. And I felt like there have been a couple of times where either he's not swinging at that pitch or he's not putting the right swing on that pitch. And when you think back to his struggles just over the course of this year and last year, primarily those have been on his swings on pitches that are up in the zone, fastballs up in the zone. And I still do think that he's getting a couple of those, he's laying off of those, but the difference from when he's hitting more consistently into what we're seeing now is just him not being able to make that solid contact on the pitches that are in his zone, on the pitches that are in the lower part of the zone. So I think for him, it's just zoning back on what his strengths are, where he wants the baseball, because at the end of the day, one way that hitters can take control back in certain at-bats, especially when you're in what I would call like the trenches, when you're just struggling up there at the plate, is knowing that the strike zone doesn't change and that no matter who is out there on the mound, they still have to bring that pitch into the strike zone. So trying to take back a little bit of control in that way and zoning in on that low part of the zone. And sometimes all it takes is that one sweet swing for it to feel really good off of the bat to get back on track. So for Davis Schneider, I'd be looking for something, especially some of those pitches on the lower and inner half of the zone, trying to look for something there that you can try to build some momentum on and to get back on track in the season.
Well, hopefully he can get a little of that against Nick Martinez tonight. We'll see if he's in the lineup there and how that goes. Opposite Nick Martinez will be Yariel Rodriguez, Madison. And he's had, you know, he's been mostly good, but there's been some up and down there. Coming off of a rougher start for him, what are you looking for from Yariel Rodriguez tonight?
Yeah, the main thing that I always keep an eye on for Yariel is just making sure that he's not walking too many batters. And I think at times that the walk numbers can start to elevate with him just because he has so much movement on all of his pitches. But I don't think he's somebody that really needs to be too fine on the outer edges of the zone just because of the movement that he has. So for him, it's all about throwing strikes through the strike zone and not trying to nitpick too much on the corners. Historically, this season, he had actually had really good numbers against left-handed batters. He ended up giving up 2 home runs to lefties in that game against the Cubs. In his last start, ended up giving up 3 home runs total, which I think could be a little bit of an outlier. But for him, it's just he's got to throw those pitches through the zone. And when he's able to do that and be able to mix with his timing and his rhythm and his release, I think he does a really good job of just, quite frankly, missing barrels. So for him, it's not so much about getting that strikeout total up. I think he just really has to rely on his stuff and the execution of his pitches moving in different directions. I think that he can have success tonight against the Reds.
Okay, Madison, before I let you go here, I don't think we'll talk to you before then. No, we won't, because today is, what, Wednesday? You're going to do Fenway for the first time next week. How excited are you?
I am so excited. I cannot wait. I can't believe that I have never been to a game at Fenway. So I will take any restaurant recommendations that anybody has for Boston, because I've never been to Boston before. But I cannot wait to finally get to experience a game at Fenway. There's just so much so much history of the game of baseball just in general that's been played in that ballpark. So I can't wait to soak in every single moment next week.
Are you able to turn like analyst brain off and just enjoy the game as a fan, or will you be like scoring the game in your head?
So, you know what? It's funny because I can't remember the last time that I've been to a game where I have not been working, whether it's baseball or softball. So I will keep you posted. I will let you know how that goes. I'm hoping that I'm able to turn my brain off, although I don't know if I'll be able to do it completely, especially since they're playing the Blue Jays. So I'll be keeping a close eye on those games for sure. But no, very much looking forward to attending those games as a fan, like you said, for the first time at Fenway. So it's surely going to be a great trip. I can't wait.
Well, a little tip for you. As we've discussed, my usual when I do pregame hit with you guys is like, yeah, once the work's done, I go sit in the seats. And then once a beer opens, that's when I'm like, okay, I can change.
Oh, there we go.
I can make the brain shift. So maybe you guys can try a little of that as well. Madison, have a great game tonight and then have a great trip next week. Thank you for doing this.
Awesome. Thank you, Blake. Appreciate it.
Madison Shipman on Blue Jays Central for this series. And yeah, fun one. I mean, Fenway's, you know, obviously it hurts to appreciate the Red Sox as a Toronto Blue Jays person, but it's a fun place to see a game. I've been there a couple times. I got to sit on the Green Monster a couple years ago. This is when the Jays were pretty good. Justin Smoke hit a go-ahead grand slam, like basically in our laps when we were sitting on top of the Monster. Also, there was a game that weekend I sat like right near Pesky's pole down the right field line, and Russell Martin hit an 11th inning home run right there as well. So this is a couple years back, but I've been there a few times. There was one time too where I watched, and Jonathan Papelbon has not been able to come on the show at any point this season, but there, and I wanted to ask him, this is like in my head, this is the Papelbon. And we were there, I think they were playing the White Sox, and he comes in with a 3-run lead and he loads the bases and then strikes 3 guys in a row. And to me, that's like the full Jonathan Papelbon experience. Anyway, Fenway's a cool place. Rogers Center, cool place tonight. It's Nick Martinez against Yariel Rodriguez. Wanted to answer one or two text line questions before we set you up for that one. Pat in Lynn, Ontario had asked today, I imagine in places like New York, they discuss what superstar players they can build their team with, not which AAA players might be bench players on a good team. If the Jays want success, they have to start thinking and acting like that. Look, Pat, I understand what you're saying. If this team had superstar players on it, promise you we would talk about those and how you build around those moving forward. Right now, it's August 21st in a year where they sold off, and the players that they have on the team, other than Vladimir Guerrero Jr., aren't those players. I can't do a two-hour show on a fictional team that I wish I was covering. Yes, in Yankee land, they're talking about Aaron Judge and Juan Soto. They employ those guys. Those guys are on their team. We will do free agency stuff, obviously, between now and the end of the year. And Juan Soto's name is on that list, just like Shohei Ohtani's was last year. But we can only talk about on the show the guys who are actually on the team and playing in these games. Much as I would love to say Juan Soto hit the 5 home runs last night, it was Springer and Kirk and Leo Jimenez and Spencer Horwitz. That's where it is. Someone who didn't sign this from BC asked, could Ernie Clement take the third base job next year? I mean, Ernie's had a really nice season. He's been playing every day. He's obviously shown the back and stick at least the, you know, average to slightly above average level, certainly an above average contact rate there, and he's solid defensively. I think probably even as someone who likes Ernie a lot and appreciates what he's done this season, you probably want to come into next season with him as like a high end bench guy. And I think this is honestly the case for a lot of these guys that are competing for spots right now is you look at this lineup and the gap between where they've been this year and where they need to get to next year from an offensive standpoint. And it's tough, you know, not all these guys can have spots. Even the guys you like, Will Wagner, Spencer Horwitz, Ernie Clement, those guys can have roles on your team. They would make up a really, really good bench. You can't have all those guys in, you know, everyday roles and still have eyes on, contending for the playoffs, let alone the World Series. So I think Ernie certainly has a spot on the roster. How big a role that is going to come down to how successful this offseason is. And then maybe a little bit also positionally, you know, if the left field and a DH are the only things that they can find in free agency to come to Toronto, then yeah, Ernie Clement's path to more playing time at third base is obvious. If Alex Bregman calls you up on the first day of free agency and says, I want to be a Blue Jay, well, then things look a little different. Ernie's also got some positional flexibility there. So I think there's a role for him, clearly. The size of it is just, it'll depend how how the offseason goes. Someone else, when we were talking about the six-inning minimum, had asked, what if relievers have to pitch to four batters minimum and then five the following year and then six? So basically, relievers have to pitch more. I think the issue is starting pitchers don't go long enough. It's not that reliever. Like, obviously, moving from a one-batter minimum to a three-batter minimum helped, or a zero-batter minimum, rather. But I think the core issue is starters not going long enough. Not that, you know, relievers only do one inning. I don't think what you're saying would hurt necessarily, but I don't think it's the core thing the league wants to address. Thank you for the questions. We'll do some more of them throughout the week. It's Nick Martinez against Yariel Rodriguez tonight. Jays haven't seen a ton of Nick Martinez. Really effective year moving starter to bullpen to starter, and he's been on a nice little roll of late. Only George Springer has seen much of him. Yariel Rodriguez on the other side, no red other than Ty France has seen him. So should be a fun one, a lot of new stuff. Thank you to Caleb McGrath, Derek Van Riper, Ben Clemens, and Madison Shipman for joining us today. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We will talk to you tomorrow, 10 a.m., to set up the Angel Series. Have a wonderful Wednesday.